BadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone, and this is podcast number 129 for April 6th. That would be Friday, I believe. Friday, April 6th, 2012. I have a couple things to cover today. The first one is going to be the least pleasant. But I want to get it out of the way. It's something I haven't talked about in a while, but I couldn't not talk about it today. I would prefer not talking about it, actually. I'm talking about the death penalty. I would prefer not speaking about it at all. But the government of China is working through the process of doing a really hideous thing, and they may or may not actually do this, but time will tell. There's a young lady who began life as the daughter of a very poor farmer in China, and she worked her way up through society, got herself, I believe she had a beauty parlor or something like that to start with, and started doing just locally, you know, near where she lived, started working and trying to put together a business. She eventually worked that into a multi-million dollar business and became one of the richest people in China. Now, when you become one of the richest people in China, you attract a lot of attention, sometimes not the positive kind of attention. Now, I don't know if this woman is guilty or innocent or whatever. She's being made out to be somewhat of a, like a Bernie Madoff type character. So that, according to the Chinese government, she was involved in all kinds of unlawful banking and unlawful fundraising efforts. Who knows? You know, I mean, who knows, really? Almost not the point. What really is the point is that the Chinese government is preparing, and whether they will actually do this or not, there's a lot of resistance in China for this taking place. So, you know, maybe it won't happen. Maybe this woman will have a little bit of luck and she'll get away with her life. But as things are going now, it appears as though the Chinese government is going to execute her for the crimes of unauthorized banking and unauthorized methods of fundraising for her business. Now, again, I'm not saying that she's, you know, pure and innocent as the driven snow, and I'm not saying she's guilty. There is some comparison in a similar way to a Bernie Madoff type scheme or scam, possibly, that she was involved in. It's hard to tell. In a government like that, you can just irritate somebody, and that's good enough to get yourself executed. But one way or the other, what we're talking about is we're talking about executing someone for what would be considered a financial crime. And let's compare it to Bernie Madoff. Back in the day, there were a lot of people so angry at Bernie Madoff that they were saying, you know, that somebody like that should get the death penalty for doing the horrible things that he did. And he did destroy people's finances. He lined his pockets. He did horrible stuff. Of course, you know, he did exactly what the Federal Reserve and what Social Security Administration have been doing for years, but that's beside the point. Anyway, but here's the question now. We have a government, like the government of China, that's going to actually kill one of its citizens because they say this citizen did not, because of business practices that are questionable. Not because this person harmed anyone, not because they did any horrible deed, not because they, and when I say harmed anyone, I'm talking about physical. She didn't attack anyone, she didn't stab anyone, she didn't murder anyone. She didn't do anything physically to anyone. She may, according to their accusations, she may have committed fraud and ripped somebody off. But is that really a legitimate reason for a government to execute someone? And again, you know, there were people right here in the United States who would have been more than happy to see Bernie Madoff executed, or the same thing goes with some of the people in charge of Enron or some of those things. And yet, you keep electing these people who are exactly like this, doing the exact same things. You people keep electing them right back to Congress again. I don't understand that. But anyway, so this brings me to a different point. And as everyone is looking at China and is looking at this evil Chinese government that's getting ready to execute this woman simply for fundraising or illegal banking or whatever, however it is they want to term this, let's think about something a little bit different. I want to read a story to you. This is from ABC.com or ABCNews.go.com. U.S. blah 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 blah. I'll try to put a link in the show notes for where this podcast appears on badquaker.com. But I want to read this to you. Ohio execution can proceed, federal judge rules. I'm not going to read the entire article, but I have excerpts out of this that I'd like to read for you. And since I didn't highlight them or anything, I'm going to be really clumsy. Ohio's first execution in 6 months can proceed, a federal judge ruled on Wednesday, saying the state had narrowly demonstrated it was serious about following its own lethal injection procedures. Now, in that opening line, there's so much wrong. The decision by U.S. Court Judge Gregory Frost ends an unofficial moratorium dating to November, when members of the state execution team deviated from the official injection procedure when putting a Cleveland man to death. The charges were minor, failing to properly check a box on a medical form, for example, but they angered Frost, who had previously criticized the state for failing to follow its own rules. The judge's decision followed a 7-day trial over the state's legal injection process last month. The ruling paves the way for the April 18th execution of Mark Wiles for stabbing a 15-year-old boy to death during a farmhouse burglary. To read on, it says, Frost, that's the judge, Frost said Wednesday he is, quote, admittedly skeptical, unquote, about Ohio's ability to carry the execution out properly, but said he's ruling in favor of the state while warning officials to get it right this time. And let's quote Frost here again. A past pattern of consistent inconsistency does not invariably mean that Ohio can never get its act together. The factual landscape can always change, both for the better or for the worse. Let's see if I can skip ahead a little bit. There's so much wrong with that. This is a judge saying this. A past pattern of consistent inconsistency does not invariably mean that Ohio can never get its act together. Holy cow. No wonder the nation is so messed up. Now, what this really is based on, if you go back in time far enough, where this started in Ohio was, there was a guy some time back. Oh, here it is. There was a guy back in 2009 that the Ohio State executioners attempted unsuccessfully for nearly 2 hours to kill this guy. His name was Rommel Broom. Actually, he's still alive. Rommel Broom. He was sentenced to die for raping and killing a 14-year-old Cleveland girl. Then Governor Ted Strickland, a Democrat, eventually called the execution off, and Broom remains on death row, arguing in court filings that Ohio shouldn't be allowed a second try at executing him. Holy cow. There's so many things wrong on so many levels. If a person was to take this and you have two decently intellectual people, and you say, okay, you're assigned the pro-death penalty and you're assigned the anti-death penalty argument, and the two people just take this article right here and the facts laid out in this article of both the current attempt to execute a prisoner and the attempt in 2009 to execute a prisoner and the other mentioned attempt back in November to killing a prisoner where they just simply didn't get their correct boxes checked on a form. And you begin to, if you had these two people, these two fictitious intellectual individuals, and they begin to make some kind of a logical argument for each side of execution, considering the evidence in this article, they would both lose. Both of them would lose. If you're making the argument that the state can't put a person to death because it's incompetent, I mean, that's really what the judge is saying here. This is why Ohio hasn't been able to execute any prisoners for so long. And the judge is now saying, well, there is this, what did he call it? A consistent inconsistency? A past pattern of consistent inconsistency? And then he says, yeah, but we'll give it a shot. What are we going to do? You know, if we mess up and he lives, you know, what do we lose? And if we mess up and he dies, hey, he's dead. I mean, this kind of an attitude about a person's life, first off, is a problem. But then for the courts themselves to admit that the state is incapable of following its own basic procedures, even to the point of spending hours trying to kill a guy, then not being able to kill him, and then shoving him back into jail and let him go on living, not knowing whether they're going to try to kill him again or not. Now, it doesn't matter which side of this you're arguing for, pro-death penalty or anti-death penalty, you come up against walls of stupidity. And why is that? Because what do you expect from government? Really, what do you expect from government? I talk quite a bit about this, the difference between the state and the government. The government is those people who are employed by and work for the government. The paychecks that are issued by the government, the buildings that they house themselves within, that they sit in their on their thrones and make judgments on other people's lives, those people are the government. All the debt that they create and all the debt that they play with and they dump on future generations and the taxes that they extract at the point of a gun, all that is the government. But the state is the myth that that's legitimate. The state is the thing in your mind that causes you to say, yeah, well, government might have some problems, but hey, it's best we got, so we're going to go with it. That's the state, the myth that's in your mind that thinks that those people acting the way that they're acting is somehow good or legitimate. So then what do we have here? We have some of the worst people in society, and I've talked about this before, regulatory capture and self-selection bias. These two economic principles create an atmosphere in government that guarantees that the worst people possible, the worst individuals for the job, will always get promoted up into that job. That's how government works. Government on every level. It doesn't matter at what point, from the smallest county job all the way up to the very top, to the presidency itself. These two economic principles guarantee that you will constantly get worse and worse and worse government. And yet, we're entirely comfortable. Well, maybe not we. I'm not. Many of you are not. But as a society, we're entirely comfortable allowing these people the ability to issue life and death decisions, even when they admittedly use terminology in reference to the state itself, to the government, the state of Ohio, but the government. They admittedly use terminology like a pattern of consistent inconsistency. And again, we're talking about people's lives here. Now, I should immediately point out one serious mistake that people make whenever someone starts talking about the government's right or lack of right to kill people. When I'm talking about, let's find this guy's name, this wonderful gentleman here, Wiles. Let me make sure I got the name right. Yes, Mark Wiles has been found guilty of stabbing a 15-year-old boy to death during a farmhouse burglary. And so that is why he's about to be executed. Now, let me get something perfectly straight so that I don't have anybody confusing this whatsoever. Let's create a theoretical situation. Let's say I have a 15-year-old son, or let's say I have a 15-year-old nephew, or I have a 15-year-old cousin, or I have a 15-year-old neighbor, or I have a friend who has a 15-year-old neighbor. Okay, so we understand here now that we have a 15-year-old and he's in a farmhouse and somebody breaks in the middle of a burglary, kills that 15-year-old. I don't care how they kill him, stab him, shoot him, whatever, it doesn't matter, not the point. This burglar, in the process of breaking in and robbing the farmhouse, kills the 15-year-old. Now, what should happen? My opinion, the burglar should have to pay for the life of that 15-year-old. And who will determine what the payment should be? The person who is directly harmed should determine. Well, of course, that's the 15-year-old. He's dead. He can't do anything. He can't decide anything. So then, next of kin. Whoever the next of kin, or whoever the representative were, in the phrase of the olden days, they used to say the champion, whoever the representative of that person is, should be able to decide what punishment should be given out. And then it shouldn't be given out blindly by somebody far away who has no connection to this. In other words, let me put it a different way. No, let's stick with this for a second. So stick with me here. I'm not saying it's not right to kill a murderer. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that somehow a person who has murdered a 15-year-old kid should walk free. I'm not even saying that the person who kills a 15-year-old kid should spend the rest of their life in jail. I'm not saying that either. What I'm saying is the state cannot produce justice. Under no circumstances can the state produce justice. The state of Ohio, the state in the world, as I was talking about the concept of the state, or any government in the world, a government cannot produce justice because the government itself is not based on justice. The government itself is based on theft and aggression. How can you expect something that is based on theft and aggression to produce justice? Let me before I just completely go into a lunatic rant, let me read something for you. This is called the preamble of the Constitution of the United States of America, and it goes like this. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Now that's the preamble to the Constitution that establishes the government within the borders of the United States. That's what the federal government was based upon, those lines. And then there's amendments to that to modify it, to clarify it, whatever. But that's the basis of the Constitution. All the rest of the Constitution, according to law and according to also judicial procedure that's well recognized within the United States, all law is based on that right there, that little joining of words that I just read. The preamble to the Constitution is the formation, is the legal formation for the federal government in the United States. And it says that the prime purpose, the reason, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice. So, the federal government establishes justice. If the federal government cannot establish justice, if the Constitution does not do what it purports to do within its very description of itself, then how can an individual state like Ohio establish justice and bring that justice down upon anyone? Let's go back to our fictitious 15-year-old kid. Now let's assume we have the 15-year-old who was murdered by a burglar. All right, now who can determine what is justice? Well, first off, we have to find out guilt. So we have whatever process that we decide to find out guilt. And so let's assume that we've established guilt. Let's not even question guilt. Let's say that there's no question whatsoever about guilt. We absolutely have, there's no doubt, the guy admits it, there's no question of guilt. Now it's a matter of justice. What is justice? All right, well, let's just compare it to a few other things. If I'm talking to a person on the street, let's say I'm talking to Bob on the street, good old Bob, and I'm standing there talking to Bob on the street, and Bob punches me in the nose randomly for no reason whatsoever, as Bob is inclined to do now and then. Everybody around knows Bob just occasionally turns violent and pops people in the nose. We all know this because that's how Bob is. All right, when Bob punches me in the nose, there is no possible way that somebody sitting on some fancy chair in some fancy hall paid for by extracted money from other people who has never been punched in the nose, there's no possible way that person can establish justice. The only person in the entire world who has ever lived that knows what it's like to be punched in the nose by Bob is people that have been punched in the nose by Bob. And no two punching in the nose are the same, because no two noses are the same. So the only person that can establish justice is the person who is directly affected by Bob's actions. I'm the only person. I'm the one that got punched by Bob. I'm the only person who can determine what justice is, because it's my nose. Now, in the case of the 15-year-old who's dead, as I said, the only person who can establish justice, or the closest thing we can get to justice, is the direct heir, or the closest relative, or the person most affected by the death of the 15-year-old. That is the only person with the real authority and right to determine justice. And if that person says, you know what, my loss of this 15-year-old is so great that the only thing that can quiet my heart is to see this murderer executed, then it should be up to that person to either execute them or arrange their execution. But no one else has the right to make that determination. If my 15-year-old son, I don't have a 15-year-old son, but if I had a 15-year-old son and if he were murdered, no one on the face of the planet would know what I feel. No one could tell me what justice is. Only I would know what justice is. I would be the only person that could determine justice. And if that 15-year-old son were important on my farm and I needed him every day to do chores and to help me with, let's say I'm disabled and I can't get around and I can't do the things that I need to do, and my 15-year-old son used to serve that function, and not only for helping around the farm but also in companionship and all these things like this, I might be such a person, I might be capable of, if you know, assuming that that let's say that I'm a very religious person, let's say I'm Amish. And let's say it's against my religion to bring a death penalty against this murderer. Well, no one can determine that but me. I might determine that the only way I can get justice is if this murderer works for me to replace the 15-year-old son I lost. That might be what justice looks like to me. And no one else on the planet has the rightful authority to say otherwise. Only me. Or you know what? That might not solve my justice problem. It might be that the only way my heart will be quenched from this terrible tragedy that's taken place is if I actually watch this person, this murderer, tortured to death. Well, you know, rightfully, his life is mine. And if that's what it takes for my anger to be quenched, then I should have the right to do that. Or if I have, or if I so choose to have this person incarcerated for the rest of his life. But you know what? If I'm going to do that, then I need to be the one paying for it. Not people in Florida, not people on the other side of Ohio, not people who have never met my 15-year-old son, or don't know me, or don't know this murderer. Those people shouldn't be taxed at the point of a gun to pay for the murderer to be kept alive for years and years and years and go through trial after trial after trial, and then eventually go through an expensive lethal injection where we go through all kinds of efforts to not have him feel anything bad. How is that justice? How is it justice to have some guy who sits on a bench, wears a robe, a bench being a court bench, not an actual bench. They have nice chairs. But how could it possibly, how could the American people twist their minds around and buy this lie that justice could come from some judge sitting there passing out his decision on this, who has absolutely no emotional tie to the situation whatsoever, And then he can go and rob other people at the point of a gun and take their taxes and keep this guy alive for years, this murderer, keep him alive for years. Well, they debate it back and forth, and all of them getting salaries off of the government and all the time paying to house and feed and keep this guy good and healthy so we can kill him eventually. How is that justice? In what twisted way could that possibly be justice? It's absolutely impossible for the state of Ohio, or for a government of any kind that's based on the concept of a state, to determine justice. It's absolutely impossible. Okay, so have I ranted on this long enough? Have I screamed about this long enough? So what do we have? We have a government in China who's getting ready to kill a woman because they didn't like the way she made money. And we have lots of Americans who were ready to do that with Bernie Madoff over pretty much the same thing. And then when we have a case where it seems cut and dry, hey, this guy, he's a murderer. He did horrible things. He killed a kid. In the process of a burglary. Why wouldn't we want to execute him? Well, then we have the government itself admitting its own incompetence and saying, yeah, well, you know, we can't follow our own rules, but hey, let's kill him anyway. You know, why not? I mean, after all, he's just some burglar scum, right? Let's kill him. And all this is assuming that this same consistently inconsistent government actually did determine guilt properly. All that's making that assumption. It doesn't matter the number of times that we have had DNA testing come through and found out that, oh, look at this, the government had the wrong guy all along, and this guy just spent the last 15 years on death row waiting to die, and then we find out he really wasn't the one that did it. All because some prosecutor was more interested in boosting his own career than actually seeing what the facts were. So are we absolutely confident that this guy is actually guilty? I don't know. I didn't go through. I didn't spend hours and hours and hours digging through his case. Like I said, maybe he's absolutely guilty. But can we trust the state, who is called consistently inconsistent? Can we trust the government, that whose own representatives call it consistently inconsistent? Can we trust that government, or any government based on aggression and based on theft, to actually determine who really is guilty, and then determine what is and what isn't justice? There's levels of lunacy here that are practically, if it weren't so serious, it would be laughable. All right, before I freak out any more on this topic, let's break for a commercial. When we get back, I'm going to go to a little bit more pleasant topic, and we won't have to think about these things again. Stick with me, folks. I'll be right back. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from BadQuaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help BadQuaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support BadQuaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do you do? Well, you go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page, and then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value, something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from badquaker.com. Thanks, folks. Thanks for sticking with me through the commercial, folks. And let's see if we can get back to something a little bit more pleasant on the old podcast here. Before we do that, I want to reread the text of the preamble of the Constitution, maybe in a little bit more calm manner this time. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Now, once again, if we can theorize that a government, based on the aggression of the state, can establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, if we can believe that a government based on aggression, lies, and theft can do these things, then what we've created here is a serious level of denial of reality. How can something, a union, the preamble calls it a union, how can a union of individuals establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity by robbing from some people, lying constantly, and using aggression to stay in business? If you can hear that, Baggy the cat has decided to come in and interrupt the podcast with some important scratching. So this important scratching brought to you by Baggy the cat. So if I'm doing my job right here, it should be obvious that the preamble of the Constitution is based on a silly, naive notion that an aggressive thief who tends towards murder, because that's what governments do. An aggressive thief that tends towards murder can somehow provide justice, tranquility, defense, welfare, blessings of liberty, the blessings of liberty. You can give someone the blessings of liberty by sticking a gun to their head and ruffling through their pockets. Makes perfect sense. This takes me to our next logical step in the podcast today. Say, listener, did you hear? 10,000 people showed up at the UCLA I'm not sure what I should have. I started to say which building they showed up, but I'm not sure which building. I can make assumptions, but I shouldn't do that. Either way, 10,000 people showed up at UCLA to listen to Ron Paul. 10,000 people. This is California, folks. This is the state that's supposed to be a place where Ron Paul's message just couldn't possibly resonate. This is a place that they're the left coast. They're those crazy liberals out in California. What would they be doing going out to a Ron Paul get together? Well, let's theorize a bit. Why would 10,000 people in California go and see Ron Paul? Well, skeptics of the Ron Paul movement might say, well, it's all kids. It's just a bunch of dumb kids. It's all college age and dumb kids. They don't know any better. Well, yeah, until you actually look at a picture of any Ron Paul rally and you see that there's a wide spectrum of age displayed there. Don't listen to what Fox News lies to you and tells you, folks. And don't even listen to what the Ron Paul campaign people, they've bought their own nonsense. Look at the pictures. There are 80-year-old people at these Ron Paul get-togethers. There are a wide variety of middle-aged people. There's baby boomers. There's young people. There's handicapped people. There's black people. There's white people. There's Hispanic people. There's all kinds of people at these rallies. This is not just one. It is not what the media is trying to tell you. And sadly, what the Ron Paul campaign has actually bought, that this is all young people. It's not young people. Look at the pictures. Sure, there are a lot of young people there. There are more young people there than show up for Mitt Romney events. But then again, when did you ever see 10,000 people show up for Mitt Romney? When did that ever happen? And yet, Ron Paul is horribly losing the nomination. And why is that? Why is it that every state that he goes to, there are huge crowds? And every state that Mitt Romney goes to, there are small crowds. And Rick Santorum, small crowds. And Newt Gingrich, non-existent crowds. More media than the crowds. And why is it? And we're told that, well, it's because all these young people, they go out to the rallies, but then they don't vote. Do you really believe that? Do you really believe that? Do you believe that people pull money out of their pockets and send it? You know, it's not like these other politicians who have massive donations from Goldman Sachs and other big corporations and all these huge donors that come in bulk. No, Ron Paul doesn't get his donations like that. He gets it from regular people pulling $10 and $20 out of their budget and sending it to him. And mounds and mounds of people showing up to these events like this. And yet, we're told they're not voting? This doesn't make any sense. At this point in time, is there anybody left who doesn't realize that the election is fake, that the vote count is fake, that the election is a fraud? Is there anybody left who believes that all these people show up for Ron Paul events and all these people put the signs on their yards and wear the t-shirts and put the bumper stickers on their cars and all these people pull $10 or $20 or $50 out of their household budget and send it to this man, and yet they don't vote? Are there still people who believe that nonsense? And yet, the vote clearly shows Ron Paul is losing in a major way. So either Ron Paul followers are idiots, or the vote is fixed. And guess what? The vote is fixed. And the vote's fixed, folks. It means nothing. So then, what's the purpose of supporting Ron Paul? And I've said this before, there are a couple of legitimate reasons to support Ron Paul. He, as everybody says, he gets the message out. He's better at getting the message out than anybody that we've had in the movement for a very long time. But there are other flaws that are pretty significant, and I want to touch on one of them today. When I think about the Ron Paul movement, and you see the Ron Paul stickers and the Ron Paul signs and everything with where in revolution where love is spelled backwards in there. We've all seen these signs and these bumper stickers and so forth, t-shirts and everything. It reminds me very much of the late 60s and the peace and love movements that were so powerful in the late 60s and early 70s, where so many young people were so convinced that all they really needed to do, you know, there was phrases like, well, what if they had a war and nobody showed up? And they had all these cute little things that people would say, all we need is love, 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 love. All we need is love. And yet, that entire movement got swallowed by the state and became completely meaningless. Everything that those people believed in, everything they worked for, it all just disappeared. And the same huggy-feely, peace and love people in the late 1960s were in charge of the Clinton administration bombing the crap out of poor countries. That's the same people, the Van Jones that are right now in charge with he's no longer officially in the government, but those people, those same people, are now the liberals that we see that are more than happy to go and bomb poor countries. Oh, you know, make excuses in any way you want. But those same people who were all about peace and love in the 60s now are all about flying drones in and assassinating people, killing wedding parties and killing teenage kids whose only crime was that their father has been designated as a bad guy by the Obama administration. So Obama's perfectly comfortable killing a whole room full of teenagers who aren't even accused of a crime in any way, only because one of those teenagers' father is on a bad guy list that Obama recently killed. And so these same liberals now, that used to sing "All We Need Is Love" are now bombing people. The ones that said, "Well, what if we throw a war and nobody shows up?" Those same people don't need people to show up for a war. They just send in a mindless drone and kill. And that's what that movement brought to you. And do you know why that movement brought you that? It's because there was no principled foundation for that movement. The entire peace and love movement of the 60s and of the early 70s, it was all about feeling good and doing this fun stuff and ending the war and doing, but it had no substance to it. It had no substance because it had no principled foundation. There was no principle. And now let's talk about a principle. Let's talk about an actual principle. The zero aggression principle is an actual principle. Slight interruption there. Well, Nikki the dog needed my attention, and so I'm back with you. I was talking about the zero aggression principle. And what we have, the difference between what we have now and what was happening in the 60s and 70s, I was saying that they had no...
Hi, Nikki.
They had no principle to base their movement upon. But we have principles. We have the zero aggression principle, and we have the principle of property rights. And using those two, and knowing that they come natural to a person, as soon as you begin to explain the zero aggression principle, they may not necessarily figure out immediately how such a thing could work out practically, but they know what's right and wrong, and they know that the zero aggression principle is right, even if they can't see immediately how it could work out practically. So oftentimes, that's our greatest hurdle, is not in trying to convince someone that the zero aggression principle and property rights are good or are acceptable or are, what is right. What's difficult is trying to get them to see that they have practical outworkings that will work. And this is really the great hurdle that we face. Now, if we take this and we consider Ron Paul, before I do that, I wanted to mention one other thing. Now, let's jump into that. What I want to do is I want to play for you a recording from Ron Paul's website. This is a recording of Ron Paul, and it's pretty much self-explanatory. Stick with me, even if you don't want to listen to it or if you've heard it before, stick with me. It's only a couple minutes long, and then I will pick back up and have some comments on this.
Last week, the Supreme Court heard arguments concerning the constitutionality of the Obamacare law, focusing on the mandate requiring every American to buy health insurance or pay fines enforced by the IRS. Hopefully, the court will strike down this abomination, but we must recognize that the federal judiciary has an abysmal record when it comes to protecting liberty. It's doubtful the entire law will be struck down. Regardless, the political left will continue its drive toward a single-payer, government-run health care system. The insurance mandate clearly exceeds the federal government's powers under the Interstate Commerce Clause found in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. This is patently obvious. The power to regulate commerce cannot include the power to compel commerce. Those who claim otherwise simply ignore the plain meaning of the Constitution because they don't want to limit federal power in any way. The Commerce Clause was intended simply to give Congress the power to regulate foreign trade and also to prevent states from imposing tariffs on interstate goods. In Federalist Paper number 22, Alexander Hamilton makes it clear the simple intent behind the clause was to prevent states from placing tolls or tariffs on goods as they pass through each state. This proven patently destructive across the many principalities of the German Empire. But the Supreme Court has utterly abused the Commerce Clause for decades, at least since the infamous 1942 case of Wickard versus Filburn. In that instance, the court decided that a farmer growing wheat for purely personal use still affected interstate commerce, presumably by not participating in it. As economist Thomas Sowell explains in a recent article, the Wickard case marked the final death of federalism. If the federal government can regulate anything with any potential effect on interstate commerce, the Tenth Amendment's limitations on the power of the federal government virtually disappeared. It is precisely this lawless usurpation of federalism that liberty-minded Americans must oppose. Why should a single swing vote on the Supreme Court decide if our entire nation is saddled with Obamacare? The doctrine of judicial review, which is nowhere to be found in Article 3 of the Constitution, has done nothing to defend liberty against extra-constitutional excesses by government. It is federalism and states' rights that should protect our liberty, not nine individuals on a godlike Supreme Court. While I'm heartened that many conservatives understand this mandate exceeds the strictly enumerated powers of Congress, there are many federal mandates conservatives casually accept. The Medicare Part D bill, passed under a Republican president and a Republican House, mandates that you submit payroll taxes to provide prescription drugs to seniors. The Sarbanes-Oxley bill, also passed by the Republican, mandates that companies expend countless hours of costly manpower producing useless reports. Selective service laws, supported by defense hawks, mandate that young people sign up for potential conscription. I understand the distinction between these mandates and Obamacare, but the bigger point is that Congress routinely imposes mandates that are wildly beyond the scope of Article 1, Section 80. Perhaps the most important lesson from Obamacare is that while liberty is lost incrementally, it cannot be regained incrementally. The federal Leviathan continues its steady growth, sometimes boldly and sometimes quietly. Obamacare is just the latest example, but make no mistake, the statists are winning. So advocates of liberty must reject incremental approaches and fight boldly for bedrock principles. We must forcefully oppose lawless government and demand a return to federalism by electing a Congress that legislates only within its strictly limited authority under Article 1, Section 8.
Okay, now that you've heard this recording by Ron Paul, I want to point out a few things about this recording. First off, I want you to understand that he's talking a lot of, Ron Paul talks a lot about the Constitution. And yet, the Constitution is written so poorly, and I realize there's a lot of people who worship the Constitution and put it into a position of almost like holy text of some kind, and I have even seen people claim that the Constitution was divinely inspired and that it was holy text. Man, the level of state worship sometimes amazes me. But in all actuality, the Constitution is written so poorly that it can be taken to mean pretty much anything. Now let's jump back just for a second to that preamble. Because remember, the preamble is, let me read what Wikipedia says about the preamble. Wikipedia says, the preamble to the United States Constitution is a brief introductory statement of the Constitution's fundamental purposes and guiding principles. It states in general terms, and courts have referred to it as reliable evidence of the Founding Fathers' intentions regarding the Constitution's meaning and what they hoped the Constitution would achieve. Now, that's Wikipedia's explanation of what the preamble of the Constitution is. And let me hit that text one more time for you. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility. Now, what exactly is domestic tranquility? Does that mean we're not threatened by things like riots? Or does that mean that no one can speak loud enough to bother me when I walk down the street? What is exactly domestic tranquility? Okay, let's go on. Provide for the common defense. Promote the general welfare. Now, there's something that has been taken to mean pretty much anything that you want it to mean. Promote the general welfare. What do they mean by that? Well, if you actually go back and read the words of people like Hamilton, promote the general welfare meant a massive, powerful state where banking interests were placed at the top of the priority of that state, and everything else was under that priority, that the banking interests were number one. That would be what what Hamilton would have argued as being the general welfare, because Hamilton felt that if the banks were doing well, that everybody else would do well. So then what does somebody like George Mason, what would he think of the general welfare? What would be to promote general welfare in the eyes of somebody like George Mason? Well, George Mason, first off, didn't want anything to do with this stinker of a constitution. He made that clear, especially after seeing the preamble. He really didn't want anything to do with it. But if we can read the rest of George Mason's writings and understand his frame of mind, then we would understand that for him, to promote the general welfare would mean to leave me alone. That would be to promote the general welfare in the eyes of somebody like George Mason. And pretty much that's what somebody like Jefferson would have thought as well. So how do we have these two totally conflicting ideas in the same generation on the same words, where Hamilton would think that the way to promote general welfare was to have the government support the banks and have the banks really successful? And yet George Mason, cell phone, and yet George Mason would consider general welfare being left alone by the government. So even in its very first inception, by the very generation of people who were around when it was being written, they couldn't agree to what these things meant. And yet now, all these years later, we're supposed to embrace this, and we're supposed to think that somehow this thing has legitimacy to it. Now, okay, so let's get back to what Ron Paul was talking about there. He mentions the Commerce Clause in the beginning of his recording. And he has to quote Hamilton's apologetics to explain the meaning of the Commerce Clause. Now, what this means is, even contemporaries to the writing of the Constitution, when they read the Commerce Clause, it was confusing to them, all the way to the point of where Hamilton had to essentially write an apologetic to explain what the purpose of this Commerce Clause was, because it was so vague it could be taken to mean anything. And so Hamilton's assuring people, no, you'll be safe, it only means this. And yet, Hamilton's words were not a part of that Constitution. Therefore, there's nothing in the Constitution to tell future generations, this is what we meant by this stupid Commerce Clause. So, by having the Commerce Clause in there, like the one about general welfare, you open the door to let anything happen. And that's what Ron Paul was talking about when he gets to the point of where he says, where he's talking about, who was that case that he quotes in here? Ah, here it is. He talks about the 1942 case of Wickard versus Filburn, where a guy who was just growing wheat on his own farm, the government went after him, because even though he was just growing wheat on his own farm to feed to his own family and his own livestock, they used the Commerce Clause to attack him and attempt to ruin his life over it. Well, so Ron Paul admits in this recording that the Commerce Clause is written so vague and that the government has used it. Keep in mind, the Commerce Clause is what the government uses to prosecute its ridiculous drug war. That you can thank the Commerce Clause for that as well. So the government uses this ridiculous Commerce Clause to mean pretty much anything they want, and now that's what they're dumping Obamacare on us under the guise of this Commerce Clause. And like Ron Paul says in the recording, this is now up for the courts to decide whether or not we will actually have this stupid Obamacare, based on what a few judges decide. Judges are going to decide this. Now, where, and Ron Paul mentions this in the recording, where in the Constitution does it give the judges the right to do that? It doesn't. This is an assumption that's been made. It's something called judicial review. Ron Paul mentions it in the recording. This judicial review is not a part of the Constitution. It's a made-up aspect of the government. And yet, there it is. Now, there one other thing that I want to mention before I really throw the final thought on this. Ron Paul mentions the German Empire when he's talking about the Commerce Clause. Well, that's a little confusing. There was no German Empire when the Constitution was written. There was the Holy Roman Empire, but as Voltaire wrote, it was neither holy, Roman, nor was it an empire. It was a very loose confederacy of principalities. So I'm not, that kind of threw me off when Ron Paul mentioned the German Empire. That's the history geek in me just cringes when I hear nonsense like that. But really, what I wanted to mention about Ron Paul's recording here is that he says, and this is a quote from Ron Paul, he says, "While liberty is lost incrementally, it cannot be gained incrementally." Let me read that again. This is Ron Paul's words. You just heard it from him. Now I'm reiterating it. "While liberty is lost incrementally, it cannot be gained incrementally." And then he goes on to say, "But make no mistake, the statists are winning." Ron Paul said that in the recording you just heard. And he also says, "So advocates of liberty must reject incremental approaches and fight boldly for bedrock principles." Now let's stop for a second here. Incremental will not work. We can't slowly get back to what he perceives as, well, he says liberty. Let's see. Yeah, he says liberty. He's not even saying get back to a constitutional government or shrink the government down to an acceptable size. He says that we can't gain liberty incrementally. We have to, so advocates of liberty must reject incremental approaches. And then what does he offer to us as a solution? What does Ron Paul offer as a solution? He says, "We must forcefully oppose lawless government and demand a return to federalism by electing a Congress that legislates only within its strictly limited authority under Article 1, Section 8. So you know what that means? Ron Paul says we can't slowly gain back our liberty. And so the solution is, let's do what we've been doing for 250 years. Won't that be a grand idea? 230 years, whatever it is. Won't that be a grand idea? Isn't that exactly, doesn't that just follow a principled pattern of logic? To do exactly what we've been doing, hoping that we can elect the right people, the magical right people into government, and those magical right people are going to do the right thing, and they're all going to voluntarily choose to follow this stupid document that was written so poorly that even within the generation that wrote it, they couldn't decide what it meant. Thank you very much. Now, what are we going to do with all these Ron Paul followers when he loses the election and they all think that all they have to do is elect the right congressman and all the whole world is going to turn to butterflies and rainbows? Folks, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights. The zero aggression principle and property rights. Not vague hope that magically somebody in government will give me back my widow whites. No. Rights. Go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much, folks. Oh, wait. You know what I almost forgot? We're putting up a new YouTube video Saturday. Check with the badquaker.com on YouTube on Saturday for the new badquaker.com video. It's an article. It's one of our older articles that we attach some pictures with it, and I think you'll like it. I think we did a pretty good job with it. So get over to badquaker.com on Saturday. There will be a link to the YouTube page. If you're not already a YouTube subscriber, do that and then share that video if you like it. Thanks a lot, folks. And thanks again for listening to badquaker.com podcast. Goodbye.